Shalom Aleichem, Chevra. This is Binyamin Hamrit, National Council Young Israel. We are now beginning Shabbos with Rebbe Rabbi Willig, Shlita, number 47. Thank you, Rebbe.
You're welcome. Question one. Some shuls leave out envelopes for donations near the shul exit. Can you take home an envelope on Shabbos to mail a donation after Shabbos? There was a well-known prohibition of hachana mishabbos lechol, preparing on Shabbos for something you're going to do b'chol, after Shabbos is over. Here's a classical case. If you look in the Mishnah Berurah, he explains this is prohibited even for the sake of a mitzvah, such as bringing wine for Abdullah. So too, it would be prohibited to take home this envelope on Shabbos, because it's hachana on Shabbos to do a mitzvah with it on Motsoi Shabbos. It would not be allowed. Question two. There's a movement known as the Kabbalah Center, which is focused on teaching Kabbalah to the public and demonstrating the relevance of Kabbalah to everyday life. Recently, the desire to study Kabbalah has become more popular in my community. What attitude should we have towards this movement? What issues do we need to be aware of? Kabbalah is known as sod, as nistar, something which is hidden. It is not appropriate for someone to study Kabbalah unless that individual is steeped in Torah and Yiras Shemayim. Traditionally, Kabbalists have been the people who have been the most famous for their Torah and Yiras Shemayim, and did they involve themselves in the study of Kabbalah. It's appropriate for Kabbalah to be studied by the masses, the more popular public, as we are reading about in the now, as a result of that, popularity has spread to beyond the Shabbos, beyond the community of B'nai Yisrael, has even gone to Einam Yehudim. They think Kabbalah is a very nice thing to study, but unfortunately, it is not appropriate. It's not appropriate. Even Talmidei Chachamim generally do not involve themselves in Kabbalah. They don't view themselves as being appropriate candidates for Kabbalah. How much more so the masses. It was a very famous, how should we say it, media star who, she was involved in Kabbalah. Very inappropriate for these holy words of Kabbalah, which are so secretive and so full of sanctity and profundity and have such a history of being studied by the greatest minds who devoted themselves, that it should be profaned by having it spread to the masses who are not fit to be studying this Kabbalah. Therefore, the rabbi should say this movement is not appropriate. If it's popular in the community, we cannot stop people from doing what they're doing. But certainly an Orthodox Rav should not be attempting to popularize Kabbalah. It's inappropriate. Again, there were those who have used even stronger language than I'm using. But suffice it to say, it should not be popularized to the outside community. Question three. Rav Moshe has a different formula and structure for naming a girl than what is in the Siddur. Which way does the Rav recommend we follow? Answer, follow the Siddur. Can the entire Ksuba and Tanoim, besides of the Kanina and the signatures, be filled out before the wedding? The answer is absolutely yes. I'll go further than that. Even the Vikanina can be filled out in advance. I believe it's not only can it be filled out in advance? I believe it's better to fill the entire ksuba, including the kanina, out in advance in order to avoid mistakes, which often happen when someone is filling things out under pressure. It's been famous that people forget the word the kanina because they want to wait until after they pick up the kli because they're worried about merzik shikra. We paskin when it comes to a shtar, we're not worried about merzik shikra. And if we were, then even the beginning of the ksuba, which says, she married him, it's also not true at that point in time. So therefore, it seems to me it's much better to fill the entire form of the ksuba out and the tanoim, everything, in advance. Of course, the signatures have to wait till the end, that's obvious. But everything else should be filled out in advance. And this way, it's much less of a chance of making a mistake. Of course, you should always bring an extra ksuba with you. Tanoim doesn't matter if it's a mistake. It's kosher anyway, it doesn't really matter at all. Next. A ksuba was filled out with the chassan ben father every time it mentions the chassan. as opposed to the father's name at the beginning and just the chassan name later on in the ksiba? Does that matter? Doesn't matter. It's not necessary. You only traditionally put the father's name in the first time and the last time, the four times in between. You only mention his name without his father's name, but you should have decided, by mistake, if you will, to include the father's name six times instead of two times. It's of no consequence. The ksuba is 100% kosher. Do I recommend using a last name anywhere in the term of ksuba? I personally do not recommend using last names for a variety of reasons. It's hard to spell it. In a case where the last name is unclear, for example, there was just a wedding less than 2 weeks ago, and the rabbi wasn't sure which of three names to use for the woman. Her maiden name, the name from her first marriage, or the second marriage. It was a complicated story. This is not a good idea in my view. It is true that Rav Moshe has a tshuva where he says that the last names are advisable. Rav Soloveitchik felt the same way, and I'm not able to argue with these giants of Torah. On a practical level, no one thinks that it's what we call ma'akeh. No one thinks that the ksuba is possible without it. And since there's so many problems with it, my view, it's better to leave it out. Because again, those who put it in, they should make sure to get it right. Question four. Can one bring in a newspaper that was delivered on Shabbos morning, assuming it landed in someone's yard porch where they can carry from? Does it make a difference if it is a daily delivery or only a weekend delivery? If it's permissible to read part of the newspaper, which is questionable, sometimes the whole thing talks about business or other things which are not permissible to read on Shabbos, but if some part of the newspaper is permissible to read on Shabbos, then it's not muktzah, and you can take it in. However, if it was printed on Shabbos, in other words, Friday night, after Shabbos came in, which can easily happen, especially in the wintertime, there are those who claim it's what's called nolad. Nolad is a form of muktzah. Some say it's called nolad gomer. It came from nothing, and therefore there are some who claim that you may not even touch it on Shabbos, having nothing to do with carrying inside, outside. This is considered to be nola. Now, aside from that, if the paper is going to be printed on Shabbos or Friday night, there are many who claim that one is not allowed to order such a newspaper. Because by ordering the newspaper, you're basically telling the newspaper company to print a newspaper for you on Shabbos. Amir Lenachri. Now, of course, it's true that if you cancel, it's not going to make a difference. But if all the Shomer Shabbos Jews will cancel their subscription to the newspaper on Saturday's edition, no question they're going to make an adjustment and print fewer newspapers because they don't want to throw them into the garbage. They have subscriptions. They know that there are X thousand fewer subscriptions on Saturday than Monday through, or Sunday through Friday. They'll print less. So it seems to me it's a big problem to order Saturday's paper to be delivered if it's going to be printed on Shabbos. It's printed on Friday, and then that problem doesn't exist. Now, daily delivery or weekend delivery does not matter in and of itself. Again, sometimes a weekend paper is printed before Shabbos. That's a different story. You have to find out the details before coming to a conclusion. Question five. Our shul is in the midst of a capital campaign to expand and build an additional floor above the balcony women's section. We have a fair amount of seniors and mothers who push strollers. The woman walk up 16 steps to reach the balcony. The board is asking that we build a Shabbos elevator to accommodate those who need it. Would it be better to build a small women's section on the main shul floor for those who need it than to start with a Shabbos elevator? If it's a Shabbos elevator, what mechanism must we have to prevent chilul Shabbos? Does having a halachically acceptable Shabbos elevator permit everyone to use it? All good questions. It seems to me it's better to have a small women's section on the first floor rather than build a Shabbos elevator, because every Shabbos elevator has its halachic questions and its halachic detractors. There are many who feel that it's permissible to go up in a Shabbos elevator, but not down. When you go down in most elevators, your weight is being utilized to power the various things that require power, such as the brakes of the elevator, maybe even the lights. So that's why going down is more problematic than going up. The Reb Shlomo Zalman has a long, long footnote in Shmir Shabbos Kilchasa. We permit it. Not everyone agrees with that psak. So therefore, it seems to me, to sum up, that to go up the Shabbos elevator would be permissible. We'll call it the tzorach, for a need. To go down, I would say only permissible the tzorach godol, for a great need. If you have to have a Shabbos elevator in the shul, make sure to buy the right kind that has these various kinds of tricks to avoid Chilul Shabbos. In other words, you can't walk out while there's a warning before the doors close. It warns you, don't go out, don't go in. So you shouldn't inadvertently be mechallel Shabbos by interrupting the electric eye while it's supposed to be going closing or opening the door. These are important safeguards. And there are also some models that are, quote, better from the perspective of Shabbos. Try to buy the best model you can. But again, even with the best model you can, not everyone agrees you're allowed to go down. And even going up, there's some machloikas about it. Better to have a first floor women's section for those who need it, in my opinion, rather than rely upon a Shabbos elevator. Question six is a follow-up. A couple has booked a hotel room and will be there over Shabbos. The room is in the 23rd floor. They could walk up. It would take a while, inconvenient, uncomfortable, but not life-threatening. Are there any parameters that they could use the elevator if a non-Jew pushes the buttons for them? The hotel does not have a Shabbos elevator. Better they should walk up to 23 flights. Good exercise. Rather than go use a Shabbos an elevator with a non-Jew pushing the button. Now, it's true. There are those who say it's permissible to have a non-Jew press the button, and their logic is that there's no Issa d'oraisa, no Torah prohibition by pressing the button, which is true according to most authorities against the Chazon Ish. Chazon Ish says any time we make an electric circuit, it's a d'oraisa, mena Torah. Most posts can disagree and say it's the Rabbanan. And if it's the Rabbanan, there's a klal called shvus d'shvus b'moko mitzvah, which means in the case of a mitzvah such as going to shul, going to have a suda, it would be considered a permissible to do a shvus to shvus, to ask a non-Jew to do something that even if you, the Jew, did it, would be a derabbanan. However, it's not so simple that we allow ourselves to put ourselves in this kind of a situation. According to my analysis, the heter of shvus to shvus, the makom mitzvah, is based on a principle known as sveika derabbanan lekula. It's not clear whether there is an Easter of Amira Lenachri, as if it's considered to be your shaliach, it's a gemara above a messiah dafsadi. It's an unresolved question, and therefore we have a right to be lenient mishum sveika derabbanan lekula when it comes to a shvus. But if you look at Magen Avraham, Siman Yud Aleph, you get an impression that sveika derabbanan lekula is something which we enter into when we have a problem, in a pinch, when we're stuck. We're not supposed to, in the first instance, enter into a situation where we're relying on sveika derabbanan lekula if there's no significant need for it. And therefore, it seems to me, it's much better to walk up the 23 flights rather than to rely on the heter of a shvus to shvus of Baka Mitzvah, which is based on sveika derabbanan lekula. Question 7. I heard a shiur from a Rav who said that when dealing with the case of Mamzeris is a loophole, which would annul the Kiddushim, and therefore the woman would never have been married and would not need a get. He said the loophole is as follows. The husband is told to send a get now to his wife via a shliach. He will then nullify the shlichus, which according to this rabbi would make it that the Kiddushin was nullified, was never valid Kiddushin. This will make it that the children are not Mamzeir. I never heard this before, and I wanted to know what my opinion is. The Rav claimed that this procedure is done more often than one would think. It's based upon a Tosfos in Masechta Gittin, Daf Lamed Gimel. Two opinions, whether you apply the principle of Ki'inu Rabbanan LeKiddushin Minei, which is found there in the Sugya, to a situation of this type, where it's done in a purposeful fashion, that the whole thing is just a charade in order to achieve the desired result of Yecholin Mamzerim LeHitoyer, as Tosfos asks the question. Two opinions whether the trick works or doesn't work. Most authorities claim it should not be done. The famous one who wrote about it was the Maharsham, Sholem Moshe Shvadron, who 100 years ago was the greatest person in Galicia. He himself was unsure whether one could rely on this in practical life. And the Gedolim of the last generation, the Rav Waldenberg and Tzitz Eliezer and Rav Shlomo Zalman and Mincha Shlomo and Rav Moshe Feinstein, Zecha Tzadik and Levrocha, all felt that it should not be used. So it may be done more than one would think. Doesn't mean that it's proper. So I would say it's better not to do it. 8. Should Rabbanim be encouraging their congregants to be buried in Israel? I do not believe so. There's nothing wrong with being buried in the United States of America. A person wants to be buried in Israel, that's fine. That should be a personal decision which every individual should make. It's not the rabbi's job to be encouraging it. Question 9. With regard to Erev Chatzeres in a multi-dwelling building with Jews and non-Jews, discuss the practical differences, if any, between an apartment house, condominium, co-op, and hotel. When is one needed? How does one go about the schiris, reshus, etc.? What difference is there, if any, the building is in a neighborhood, has its own Erev for the entire area? Well, one has to, in an apartment building, we pass in the halacha, you have to do what's called a schiras reshus, which means you go over to the landlord, or to the superintendent, or the doorman, someone who works, what's called schiro lakita, who works for the landlord, and you can give him a penny, and say, I'm renting out all the commonly used areas, which includes, of course, the hallways, the lobby, and whatever other yards maybe belong to the building, and you're renting it out for religious purposes, and this works as a schiris reshus, kind of a nominal schiris reshus, and this has to be done. Rav Moshe Feinstein, and it was Moshe, has a very big chiddush. He says, based upon the Gemara says that if the landlord has the right to store some of his objects in the home, there's no need for a schiris reshus. Rav Moshe says a chiddush that in most apartment buildings, the landlord, in fact, is storing some of his things. We call them an oven and a refrigerator. That would do the trick. Most authorities disagree, because the oven and the refrigerator are not there for the purpose of the landlord, they're there for the purpose of the tenant. And therefore, they claim it would not satisfy this requirement, and therefore it's required that someone should do the schiras reshus in order to then proceed to make an Erev Chatzeres. I believe the same is true for a condominium and a co-op. A hotel might be different. In a hotel, many hotels, the proprietor has the right to move an individual from one room to another. There are some very famous stories where people reserved a certain room, and then a celebrity came, a politician, and the owner of the hotel said, listen, mister, you have to leave because this major politician needs these special rooms, and apparently it's in the contract that he has the right to move him. And that, according to many authorities, would obviate the need for an Erev Chatzeres, because no one is considered to be a real resident in any kind of way, because they're at the mercy of the proprietor. Not everyone agrees, but there's room to be leaned in a hotel. After you rent from the or in the apartment house, co-op, or condominium, then you have to give a small amount of money. The two people, one person gives it to the other and asks us to pick it up on behalf of all the building that are here right now, and that will move. And the box of matzah should be kept in somebody's apartment. If that person goes away for Shabbos, you should make sure that one of the neighbors has the key or move the box of matzah to another place. This is what's called an Eruv Chatzeros. Of course, if they're relying on the Eruv Chatzeros and the other tikkunim and mechitzos of the neighborhood at large, there's no need to make an additional Eruv in the building. Question 10. We have a number of people in the shul who had a conservative reform of secular weddings many years back. The likelihood of their ksubas being invalid is high. One family approached me to have a kosher wedding after 20 plus years of marriage. One, what are the necessary steps needed to make this a kosher wedding? Two, can we do multiple weddings at the same time, a marvin simcha v'simcha? The answer is, in my view, if the family is now observant and is living in a community of observant Jews, there's a very good chance that they're married already. There's a principle known as Ein Odom Osa Bilaso Bilas Nus. These people who understand very well after their minchos v'beshuva that the initial reformer conservative marriage is likely invalid. The best proof they're coming to you now to do it again, they must have realized that before today. And therefore, they have in mind that their marital relationship should serve as a marriage. And they're living in a town where there are many people who are Orthodox, Shomer Mitzvahs, who know that they're going into their house every night together. And therefore, it's very possible that they are married already. Therefore, since one could argue they're not married, it's a good idea to do a new kiddushin without a bracha. All you need is find two witnesses. The rabbi can be one of them. And the man should take an object of value. If the woman wants, she can give the wedding ring back as a gift to her husband, total gift. And he will give it back to her b'toras kiddushin, saying harayat, the nine words in the presence of the rabbi and one of the witnesses. And then you write a nuksuba. You write a nuksuba. And, you know, how to write it exactly is a bit of a question, but it may depend a little bit on the circumstances, how it should be written, but not so hard to figure out. And after you write that nuksuba, he gives it the ksuba, and they have the nukidushim, that's enough. We're not going to make any sheva brachas, because maybe they were married from before, as I said. And for that same reason, since there's no sheva brachas, they're not going to have a question of ein ma'arvin simcha b'simcha. There's no real simcha happening over here. This is the way we do it. And as far as what we call nisuim, the fact that they go back to their apartment and people know about it, that itself is the yichud, which is sufficient in this kind of a case. Question number 11. Under what guidelines can a diabetic test their blood on Shabbos? In a particular case, the doctor wants it to be done one meal a day, 20 minutes before eating and 2 hours after, but the same meal every day. We have a rule. Pikuach nevash is docha Shabbos. Not that you not can test, must test. It's not a heter, it's an obligation. If the doctor who's a good doctor, he determines that you need to do it twice a day, let's say before or after lunch, as the case may be, you are required to do it. However, because it's Shabbos, you should do what we call with a shinui. It's possible to do it with a shinui. The main thing that you have to worry about is the getting the blood out of the body, which is a problem. These days they have these special implements. You press down and it takes a little bit of blood out. But instead of pressing down as you would normally by putting your hand right down straight, you do it backwards. You can turn your arm upside down, so you're hitting that button with the back of your hand, literally kalachayat, or maybe use your elbow, it's the case, maybe, again, if it's possible, it should be done with a shinun. Question 12, is there anything different from opinion of Ben of the child of a Gioris? The father was born Jewish. The answer is no. As long as we're certain that the Gioris had no children before this one, a regular pidyon haben is done. Question 13, finally. Can I provide suggestions for reducing, eliminating, talking during davening and laning? If I could answer this question properly, then there'd be a lot of happy rabbanim. Unfortunately, it's not so easy. For the rabbi to get up and say it's prohibited to talk during davening and laning, experience has shown this in and of itself doesn't get too far. That's the reality of the time in which we live. Rather, it seems to me that the way to do it is by speaking in a positive fashion. A positive fashion. Speak continually about the importance of davening and the importance of Kriyas HaTorah. It's such an important mitzvah. You're davening, you're speaking to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and the laning is the recreation of Ma'amad Har Sinai. And it's talking in a positive sense. It should be so important in their eyes, it wouldn't even enter their mind to talk. Forget about it. You wouldn't talk, you know, when there's some kind of other activity which is important in people's eyes, they wouldn't talk. They wouldn't talk in the middle of davening in the time when it's prohibited to talk. They wouldn't talk in the middle of laning when it's prohibited to talk. Davening, you cannot talk, as we know from Baruch Sha'ama, till after Chazaras Hashatz, you're not supposed to talk. This is quoted. You can't speak for three, four different reasons. But that's a long chunk of time. And Kriyas HaTorah proper, while the Balkari is speaking and the brachos are being made, you're not permitted to talk. Now it is true that there are breaks in between. After Chazaras Hashatz and Kaddish, you can't talk during Kaddish either. The break between then and the time they start the actual laning, there's a little break between Gavra and Gavra. There we cannot be as absolutely rigorous in stating the prohibition. Nonetheless, it's a matter of what we call Kedushas Beis HaKnesses, the sanctity of the synagogue. It's a holy place. You should only speak there if you can. Divrei Torah, and if there are breaks in the action and you just can't just look at the walls, take a chumash, look at the chumash in Rashi, the Midrashim, or they have now the Mefarshim, they have now these Torah weekly sheets that are given out. There's plenty to do when they have these breaks. Having said that, I would say that in order to help reduce or eliminate talking, to try to make the davening shorter. People complain the davening is too long, it drags on, and they get bored, and they're going crazy, and they have to start chattering. It seems to me that there are a number of ways to reduce what we call the tircha de sibur and the lengthy davening. Number one, person gets an aliyah, one mishaberich. That's all. Everyone knows you can make a mishaberich. During that mishaberich, the next person comes up to the bima. There's no time lost anyway. If there's a simcha, and when there's a simcha, it's traditional to make mishaberichs for the family, the gabbai should request that he have a list of all the names that he's going to have to mention in the mishaberich for that particular simcha, bar mitzvah, ofrah, sheva brachos, as the case may be, and he can rattle it off. Just don't. Very often there's no list. He starts pausing, and this one, and this one, and this one, and people are talking like there's no end. But if it goes quickly, less of a chance for there to be that much talking. Mishaberich for cholim, I know it's a hard thing to accept, but it became impossible. People talking right through it for such a long time. In my shul, a number of years back, he makes a mishaberich for cholim. He stops, who you brought the rabbi sacholah, there's a pause, he waits for a minute, rabbi can insert the name quietly of the person or persons that they wish to have a refuah shleima. He finishes the mishaberich, and it's done. This seems to be the best way to do it under these circumstances. Of course, the rabbi should repeatedly remind people that they should not be talking in shul. And this way, I believe, with a combination of this primarily positive message, we can reduce talking significantly, especially during the times when it's actually prohibited, as I said, during Kaddish, or from Baruch Shem until after Chazar HaShat, and during Kriyas HaTorah proper. Maybe it can even be eliminated. The people will know the halacha. Halacha is halacha. You're not allowed to talk. And even the time when there are breaks, you can reduce it. It shouldn't be, when I was growing up in the shtibel, the rabbi used to yell out in Yiddish, Vosidot ayerid. He read me like a fair, when people come like a marketplace. It was, people were talking too much. He was very, very upset. After all the positive reinforcement, then, I believe, and only then, can you mention that the Shulchan Aruch says that someone talks during Chazar HaShat, Godol Avono Min So, that the sin is too great to bear, but Gorin Bo, and you can scold him. I don't believe it's going to work initially. You have to start with a positive. Maybe at the end, if it's not working, a little bit of this kind of negative talk, but only afterwards. And the Mishnah Berurah there writes that shuls that people talk in are ultimately destroyed. My interpretation is in America that the neighborhood changes. You know, in the Tach V'Tat, when the Tosfos Yontif made his Mishaberech, he was fearful that the communities were destroyed, literally killed out, because they were talking during davening. So he made a Mishaberech for those who will keep quiet during davening. And one of the famous shuls things got so bad that the rabbi introduced this Mishaberech of the Tosfos Yontif, and that week it was absolutely silent. The next week, they went back to talking, but they were quiet during the Mishaberech of the Tosfos Yontif. And the third week, they talked to that Mishaberech too. So that itself is not going to carry the day in most circumstances. My interpretation, now that we live, thankfully, in a free country where Jews are basically safe, the fulfillment of the Mishnah Berurah's idea of the shul being destroyed is that the neighborhood changes. The neighborhood changes. The Jews no longer live there. And the neighbors and the shul is either destroyed or worse, no longer used as a shul. And, of course, you can tell the Balabatim that if the neighborhood goes down, their real estate values will go down. So, therefore, they have a vested interest that the shul should survive and that their neighborhood should survive and that their home should survive. Maybe this positive message will get them to stop talking. Again, the most important thing is to say that davening is important and laning is important and the davening should not drag on too long. And this way we hopefully, can reduce and perhaps even eliminate talking during davening and laning. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rebbe. We hope we can call upon you again in the near future. Thank you.
Call to.
Bye-bye.